This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
And now it is a pleasure and an honor to introduce Nikki Giovanni, who is a living legend and a national treasure. She has been a vital public presence for more than four decades as a poet, activist, and educator. Among her many honors, she has been awarded an NAACP Image Award 7 times. She is the first recipient of the Rosa Parks Women of Courage Award and also a recipient of the Langston Hughes Medal for Outstanding Poetry. She has published more than 24 books. A Good Cry looks back on her life, recalling the grandparents who took her in, her parents' violent marriage, as well as her takes on education and on how Black Lives Matter, but not as a hashtag, and especially on her long friendship with Maya Angelou. Before I introduce her, I have a surprise. These flowers have come for her from a friend, and I'm going to read the little note here that they came with. All you really need is good friends to share a good cry with. Utopia too, if you can afford it. Love you, Nikki. Kwame. In Chicago, or I'd be there. And so please join me now in welcoming Nikki Giovanni to Politics and Prose.
Is like my literary son, and when you teach, and I'm sure we have many teachers in the room, you know, you want your kids to do well, but actually you want your kids to do extraordinary. and Kwame won the Newbery, and thank you. And I had, I'm old, first of all, and I had a, you don't have to be sick because you're old, but I had a, which is another story, I guess, really, I had a, what do you call it, a seizure. And that's a long story. I'm driving down the street, and my friend Randy called me. Everybody could tell something was wrong, you know, I'm driving. And so Randy called Jenny, whom some of you know and some of you don't, and said, I think something's wrong with Nikki. Well, one of the people I listen to no matter what, I listen to Jenny, whatever her voice is, and I listen to my attorney, whom I've known forever, and I love her so much, Gloria. And so Jenny said, I'm going down 81, you understand? Jenny said, turn around. And clearly, something the hell was wrong with me because I turned around. It's a wonder I didn't get killed. But I turned around, and she said, come to Montgomery Hospital, which I did. And it was later that I found out I did exactly what I was supposed to do because I backed it in. I did everything, but I didn't know that. And when I woke up a couple of days later, Kwame was there. And I thought, I must be, you know how you go, like, I must be dreaming. Something is wrong, you know, because I think I see Kwame. And he said, Nikki. And I said, yeah? He said, you have to get well. I won the Newbery. You have to come to California. And I got well and went to California. I followed instruction. Back in the back, there is a book of mine that's called Love Poems. And if somebody will bring it or send it or throw it or somehow get it to me, I should have picked it up when I came in. I just want to borrow it if it's okay. Now, because we're here today. We're here today, I know, talking about a good cry. And now the polls in Virginia have closed. Yeah, it's, and it is, of course, my sincere hope that Nordstrom has won. Yeah, it'd be nice to have just somebody make sense. And it would, that fool that lives in the White House here, you know, good Lord. But, no, that's a whole nother thing. And I'm sure some of you are her friends, and so I'm just going to say this once, and I'm not going to, like, dwell on it as I have done at other places. But that bitch down in Brazil is crazy. That's true. You know, why she have to put a book out that accuses Hillary? Well, that's a long, I just said, and I'm gonna do that. I'll say this and then I won't get invited back to, but speaking of where not to go, we were down in Charlotte, which was really wonderful. The Charlotte Mecklenburg Library is a wonderful event, wonderful. And I don't normally like forget where I am, but I'm in North Carolina, right? And I'm at a fundraiser, and they raised like $270,000 or something. So I was really incredibly pleased. And I'm standing talking to, 1,200 people or so as I'm talking to you. And just happened to mention, which I said, if you'll excuse my language this way, and that motherfucker in the White House. And said, don't go. And I realized, I'm in North Carolina. I will never be invited back, You can't always be invited back. But I asked for this because I got, everybody with any sense is angry with that fool. But, it's the truth. And I don't know how you all feel. I teach at Virginia Tech. We have a football team. I like football. And when I watch the young men, I watch Colin, and then we watch the others, and they're taking a knee. Now, as a woman, and we have a lot of women in this room, because we have some men too, but as a woman, we know that when a man gets on his knee, it's an act of love. With the possible exception of Hollywood. But you know it's true. But it is an act of love. And the Constitution, last I heard, is always referred to as a woman. So when we see the men who are getting on their knees and they're saying to the Constitution of the United States, do you love me? Will you be mine? Will you be truthful and honest with me? Can I count on you? It's an act of love. And I don't see how Trump or any of those other sons of bitches can take away from what the black men are asking. There is no nicer thing that they've done. That's true. And it just really teased me off because it looks like no matter what black men do, somebody's gonna find something wrong with it. And you think that, you guys have to grow up. You have to leave them alone. This is a great thing that they do, and they're right. One of the things that Black Lives Matter, which I did talk about here, but I'm going to do something else for a minute. One of the things that Black Lives Matter did is it made the Ku Klux Klan have to take the hoods off. They have to. Because you remember how they would, you don't remember much or you're too young. But the Klan would run around, in the middle of the night, they're going to come and get a 14-year-old boy that they're accusing of something that whether he did or didn't do, they shouldn't have done what they did, but they nonetheless he didn't, and now we find out that the bitch lied about that, which we all knew was a lie. And so now if the Klan is gonna come, they're gonna mostly be policemen, of course, because we know that, because that's who shoots unarmed people now. That's another discussion, isn't it? I wrote a poem and I wanted to share it, and one of the things that happens with this book is crying is a skill. And it really is. Some of us know that and some of us have seen it. And they're not gonna let me, they say you only have 20 minutes, Nikki, but I wanted to share this because crying is a skill. And one of the things that I mentioned in A Good Cry is I married my mother. And I'm starting that line with crying is a skill. Because one of the reasons I started this whole discussion with, and I had a seizure. And my doctor, who is a doctor, Gregory's really cute, thank God. Not that he has to be cute, but it always helps when they are. And he is. And Gregory said the reason I had a seizure is that I keep things in. And so I have to, you know, I need to take pills now to, you know, to control it. And I said to Gregory, the reason that I have had a seizure is not that I have high blood pressure, which is what he says. I said the reason is I never learned to cry. And so we're having this fight going on. Obviously, when I drop dead, I'm going to have won it because I think that... It's true. Well, let's say I think that Gregory should take credit for a symptom, and it ought to be called the Nicky, right? And with people, well, everybody else gets something named after them. And then when you go to the hospital, and they say, oh, yeah, you've got the Nicky. You see what I mean? And I think it would work like that. But I'm saying this because this makes me sad in a way. One of the great things that black men have done a lot of great things, but we're not here. This is not Nicky's history of black men. But a lot of the things that they did, what they did in 1995 at the March on Washington, when the Million Man March, was a great thing. And I just wanted to have a statement. It makes me cry, and I'm hoping that I don't. And if I do, maybe somebody have a tissue. This is in my love poems, and that's why I decided I wanted to share it with those of us in Washington, because somebody here might be important and you'll understand and learn something. That wasn't nice, was it? My heart went out, okay. And yeah, this is a love poem, October 16th, 1995. It's not that I don't respect the brother in Baltimore or Washington or even some parts of Northern Virginia, because I do. It's just that this is different. The brother who had to wake up before dawn, get into a car that may or may not need a new muffler, a new set of spark plugs, some attention to the motor, but who decided nonetheless that yes, he had to heed the call to go to Washington, D.C. That's the brother I want to talk about. Not at all, please understand, that I don't have a high regard for the brother who got on the bus. Getting on buses has always been a central revolutionary act of black America. Just ask Plessy or Parks. No, getting on a bus is an act of responsibility, an act of bravery, an act of commitment to change. But the brother who rose from his warm bed, who made his own coffee because his wife pretended to be asleep because she was scared that he might not come back alive, and she didn't want to let him see the fear in her eyes because she knew he needed to go, even if he wouldn't come back alive. That's the brother I want to talk about. I want to talk about the young brother who just didn't understand why everything he did, no matter how hard he tried, never seems to come out right. How if you went bowling and got 9 pins, the 10th pin would just stand there mocking the ball headed for the gutter. How if he bumped into somebody on the street and said a simple, I'm sorry, somebody else would jump in his face. But if he didn't say anything, then somebody would say he was uncouth. And how sometimes people would even deliberately run into him. So he joined with other people like him. And instead of calling it a benevolent society or a brotherhood or something wonderful and romantic like Elks or Masons or Lions or Rotarians, they call it a gang, indicating it was a nest of vipers, and terms like that, indicating the things we find dirty and unacceptable. How when 4 or 5 white boys rape a mentally handicapped girl, they are just exercising bad judgment. But when 4 or 5 black boys rape a jogger, they are all animals. And this is not for any brother who rapes any female, and it's not for anyone who hurts women or other vulnerable life forms. But just a word or two about the black boys who don't understand why everything they ever try to do just never seems to come out right. And I think, of course, yes, why wouldn't they cry themselves to sleep when all they want to do and want to be and want to already be has been denied them? Why wouldn't they be afraid of the dark? Why wouldn't their hearts be broken when the people they love, mothers, fathers, aunts, uncles, girlfriends, good buddies, teachers, preachers, all turn out to be untrue? And please, don't tell me that basketball and baseball and football aren't the way to go, that they should get their education, when their education will only tell them to get a talent, because the people who get out, if not out of these cesspools we call the inner city, have something more than a high school degree behind them. And you have to be some kind of a real fool not to see that they see who makes the money and who doesn't. This is for the brother, however, who does indeed believe that there can be and should be and must be a change. It's not that I am unhappy in any way about the brother who has a fine home, a car that is always serviced on time, a job with health benefits, a pretty wife, happy, smart children, a dog that obeys. I'm proud and happy for him and his because I know a people cannot do better unless individuals do better. But this is about the brother who stands on the street corner singing five-part a cappella harmony, and the brother who does breakdancing under street lights, and the brothers who created rap because they took the music classes away, so the brothers scratched, and then they invented CDs, so the brothers rapped, and then they said rap is an enemy of women, as if Bob Dole and Rush Limbaugh and self-satisfied Republicans with bumper stick mentalities don't exist. So this is for the brother who is simply trying to find a tone to soothe his soul, while everyone wants to make him the reason America is off track. And this is about the brother who, knowing he is a better person than even he thinks he is, got in his car in Detroit or Cincinnati or St. Louis and headed for Washington, not knowing if he would be the only brother to show up for the Day of Atonement, but knowing if he was the only brother, then on that day, at this time, he would be the brother to stand and say to himself, his brothers, and all the folks he loves and who love him, I am sorry. Things are not different. And this is a mighty powerful thing to say because the people might want to make you make the mistakes when all of us can actually only say, I wish it would be different. But this is for the brother who was willing to be the only brother so that if there would be laughter as he stood alone on the mall, he still said, I will stand because today it doesn't matter if I'm alone. I need to stand and testify. And yeah, this is a love poem for that brother who decided, for this one point in time, I will be my better self. And we are all so proud of you. Thank you. Thank you. Problem is, once you learn to cry, you end up just, you know, but you just get sick of it. And so thank you, because I really love that poem, and I wanted to share it. And that was before this. And I really like A Good Cry because it's probably my most vulnerable book, as you can see. I'm 74 years old, so one of the things about my surgeon and I have a surgeon, and my surgeon and I are arguing, because she says, I don't know why you need surgery. You're only going to live 5 more years anyway. Yes, she did. I have to hope she's kidding, but you know, I know one thing I said to her, well, bitch, you won't get paid if I do. So we worked that way. Are they children? Well, you have to kind of, she's really nice. I like A Good Cry. Because it's probably my most vulnerable book. And I honestly, you know, when we do these things, we're supposed to talk about the book. And I honestly, I honestly think it's a good book, you know, in many respects. But on the other hand, I was saying the other day, and I think it's true, I think if you just go home, if you would have this, you know, it's not to sell this book or something like that, but I think if you would hold this book, you would feel the tears. And I think that sometimes you have to be, there's a lot of us in this room also I know write, you just have to be vulnerable. And I started writing, 50 years ago. And I made a decision 50 years ago. I wrote a poem, which was a good poem, by the way. Well, yeah. Well, some of them weren't, but I know that a couple that were. And it's called Nikki Rosa. And in Nikki Rosa, the last line is going to say, and all the while I was quite happy. And I knew I wasn't happy when I wrote that poem. And dealing with it, though, I know that you have to make a decision about your happiness, because otherwise you let people bother you and you be crazy, and you shouldn't let that happen. So I decided, because my father had issues, and I guess there's another way to put it, but I once saw Gus, I called him Gus, but I once saw Gus hit Mommy so hard she literally flew across the room. And so, you know, you can't do that. You have to make up your mind. Either that's going to make you crazy or you're going to find a way to live your life, to make it make sense to you. I was very fortunate I had a grandmother. And I went down to grandmother's, and going to grandmother, one day we were just standing there and we were just talking. It was just one of those, like, can I stay? And she said, yes. She said, I'll talk to John Brown, but that's her husband. And I talked to John Brown, but yes. And so, you know, John Brown's going to say, but they loved each other. So it was a good thing to stay. When I went to live with my grandparents, and some of you may end up living with, you know, I have a grand. When I went to, I knew that, and they didn't ask, neither one of them asked, but you know you have to do something. And I'm compulsive. Some of you know me. And I'm compulsive. I want things in the right place. I want them, you know. And so I kept the pantry clean. I started doing all of that. But I would wash the dishes. And that was Grandpapa's job. Grandmother cooked, but Grandpapa had to wash the dishes. And so he would keep me company while I'm washing the dishes. She smoked. He didn't smoke. She smoked. So she would go on the porch, and she'd have her cigarette. And he would sit there, and he'd say, you know, Nikki, I only wanted to kiss your grandmother. And it really didn't matter where grandmother was in the house. She could hear that. And she would say, John Brown, if I had let you kiss me, you would have never married me. And I did not understand. I kissed him every night. I just didn't understand for the longest that was a metaphor of what he wanted and what she withheld until he married her. So you learn a lot of little things from them, but it was good for me to watch them, because then you know that people can and should and do love. And my mother stayed married to my father. He finally, of course, died. And he didn't of course die me, but he did. He had a stroke, and mommy called me and said, you know, your father's had a stroke. Well, you know, if your mother calls you, say your father had a stroke, she needs help. And I had a sister, she's gone, but Gary lived in Seattle. And she called Gary. So Gary said, call me if you need something. Shit. Why do you think she's calling? So that just makes sense, you know. So I moved home, and I really did. I was laughing the other day with my audience, because it's true, and it doesn't bother me. But you know how everybody wants to go to heaven. I know I'm going to hell, so I don't have a problem with that. No, I know, because I'm mean, and I just like people, and I'm not friendly, so I know I am definitely on my way to hell, and it's fine. But I went home. Somebody got to go to hell. But I went home, and he got out of the hospital, but he was going to die because he had a stroke, and he had a bad heart, and he ended up with cancer, so he's going to die. And I was trying to think of how do I want to make this all right. It's none of my business. I realized a long time ago their marriage was no more business than who I had no more business being involved with who they were screwing each other than she has, my mother had, involved in who I was. And I would say that to all the mothers in the room, all the parents in the room, all the whatever you, whoever your children are screwing, it is none of your business. And the best way to make you happy, and you look at all those evangelicals, and all they do is worry about who you in bed with. And all I know for sure is they're not in bed with you, and they're not in bed with me. So they need to get over that. But that's another discussion. It really is. And I'm always mad that they're talking about their anti-abortion. What, I'm supposed to have him so you can lynch him? So you can shoot him? So you can put him in jail? That doesn't work. That doesn't work for me. And I'm a big fan, you know, gay community. I don't know. I think people are jealous of the gay community. The gay community looks happy. It does. They always smiling at each other. They always discovering each other, you know. And the rest of them like, damn, I'm married to that fool. That's the truth. But my father, that's another discussion. But my father got him from the hospital, and I was trying to think what I was going to do with him for the rest of his life. And I decided the best thing for me to do, and as I say, I'm going to hell for things like that, was I bought a house. And I just thought, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to buy a house, and we're going to move. His first thought was, of course, his first thing he said was, I don't want to move. I said, no, you don't understand. You're going to move, or I'm going to put you in an old folks home. Doesn't matter to me, whichever one you want. You know? So we moved. But he and I always had differences. And so one day we were having a difference. He was sitting in a chair sort of like that. And we were just having a discussion. And I said to him, Gus, you don't understand. And I'm calm, though I can be pretty mean with it. You don't understand. I said, the chair you're sitting in is my chair, which is true. The floor that the chair is sitting on is my floor. And so you could see that this is going to make him unhappy, so he's going to try to get up. And I said, the bedroom you're going into is my bedroom, and the beds you're going to stretch out in is my bed, and the mattress on that bed is my bed. So let me tell you what's going to happen here. For the rest of whatever life you have, you led that life that way. Now we're going to do it my way. You're going to wake up in the morning, and that woman who has put up with you all of these years, you're going to smile at her and tell her how glad you are that she's with you. You're going to say, I love you, honey. When she cooks dinner, you're going to eat it, and you're going to tell her how good it is. Am I clear? Well, somebody need to tell somebody, bitch, what this is the way you're going to end up with your life. And if you don't, I'm going to send you away. It means nothing to me. These are all your choices. And I meant it. And, of course, he, honey, that was a really good meal. And then I realized, for what, it's crazy, but somehow they did love each other. But she needed to hear that, having gone through all of that crap she went through. And I just thought he should do that. And then when he died, I'm going to read this poem. If you don't mind, I'll read this poem for you. Let's see if I remember where it is. When she died, if I finally got around to it, I wrote a poem. I married my mother, because I always thought, and I used to tease Mommy about that, if she had married me, it would have been a whole different life. And then somebody said, well, Nikki, how would that happen? I don't know, but I can tell you this. And then I'm going to stop this because they'll kick me out of here. I do know this. The penis is in trouble. No, we studied, you are, the penis is in trouble. The penis is right there with, you know, tonsils. Something that... Isn't that true? That's true. I'm sure you've thought about it, because we don't need the tonsils anymore. They used to take them out, and now they just don't come. And if men don't learn to do better with their penises, they're going to lose them. And I don't know. Then somebody said, well, how are we going to make? I don't know, but I know we still breathe and we still swallow. We're going to find something to do with. And the men are going to be upset. They're like, oh, honey, I lost my dick. You didn't take good care of it. So they're not going to let me come back. That's the truth. I know crying is a skill. I automatically wipe my eyes, even though I know crying is a skill. Maybe I will learn, my mother did, when she thought I was asleep. I think my sister did, sleep, but sleep is as difficult to me as crying. I laugh easily, and I smile and withhold any true feelings, except once I fell in love with my eighth grade teacher and spent most of my life trying to feel safe again, though maybe I'm safe now. After almost 30 years, which is as long as I live with my mother, maybe that's not a poem. Maybe that's something else. Maybe I just wanted to show my father that he needn't be cruel. Maybe I just enjoyed buying the house he had to live in, showing her she should have married me instead of him. Or maybe, since we will all soon be gone, I should be happy I found my mother and someone else who loves me. What else really matters? Yeah. I really like that. I really do. Thank you. And I know that probably most of you in this room, because you are, let me let you get settled. It's not a problem. How you doing? Come on. Yeah. Good. I know most of you in this room are probably too young to remember a woman named Big Maybell. No. Big Maybell was, isn't she wonderful? Big Maybell is one of the reasons that I really love, though I've never met, though I would love to meet, Bonnie Raitt. Because, Bonnie Raitt's a great woman. And when Bonnie, and not that John wasn't, her father was, you know, he sang too. But Bonnie, when she fell in love, I guess is the term, with the blues, I don't know Miss Raitt at all, but recognizing that she was singing the song that black women created, she went and collected for black women. She made sure that the black women who were still around got their royalties. She made sure they got the credit that they deserved. There must be another word for it. And she has done a lot to help with the blues. I grew up in Cincinnati. I'm a Knoxvillian by birth. I'm the first person actually in my family born in a hospital. So when my sister used to fight with me, I'm the baby in the family, my sister used to fight with me, she would say, "Oh, you know, we got the wrong baby. Nobody wanted to tell you." Because people my age were all born at home, so there's no question you belong to these folks. But at least I had mentally, I could, yeah, maybe I don't belong to them, you know, they crazy. But that's the truth. But Big Maybell, I'm a Knoxvillian by birth. I was born in, and Big Maybell was born, she's a Chattanoogan. She's born in Tennessee also. I think she's about the best thing that happened to her. I've got to find it now. But I had a boyfriend, and his name was Nate Gray. Nate's a good guy, by the way. And, 43. Thank you. And in my day, well, I guess probably even today, there was a game called the number, you know, and I'm not in a bad mood, right? And no, I'm not. But you know, everything that black people do, white people take over and claim. And you know, it was black people that played the numbers game, and white people said, "Oh, we'll call it the lottery. We'll just take it over." And that's exactly, so when it was the numbers game, it was illegal. And it became the lottery, every damn body plays it. They have ads, you know, play the lottery, you know. It makes you so mad, you know. One day we're gonna get some kids that are gonna be able to say, "Yeah, you know, it's a good thing to be black." And you know, you got that ad, have you seen that ad? It's the dumbest damn ad in the world. People are standing around, "I thought I was German. Oh, I thought I was," you know. First of all, it doesn't take much to know that whatever you are, somebody screwed somebody, because we can just look in this room and see. No. Well, you can. And it's just so, you know, like, "Oh, I'm not sure, you know, I don't want." Well, we're all mutts. There's a T-shirt that says we're all, and it's true, and you get sick of people acting like that. And it wasn't Virginia, speaking of Virginia, Loving versus Virginia was about marrying. Mr. Loving wanted to marry Mildred. And it wasn't about screwing, because black and white have been screwing or screwed, depends on how you look at it, forever. It's a question of marriage, and you get sick of that. But that... But I had a boyfriend, and he was a nice guy, and his name was Nate Gray. But Nate ran numbers, but he was very cool. I don't know if you've had cool boyfriend. He was really cool. And Big Maybell was coming to I don't know what you know about the history of it, but Big Maybell was coming to Kentucky. There was a place called Newport, Kentucky, which is where the dirt was. Cincinnati had the clean money, and Newport had the dirty money, until a guy named George Radiman, which is neither here nor there, ran for sheriff, cleaned it up, and now, of course, Newport doesn't have a penny, a pot to piss in the winter, throw it out of, and Cincinnati doesn't either, and you get sick of that. But Big Maybell was coming, and Nate knows that I like music. I'm only 15 years old, you have to understand. So Nate asked Mommy, could he take me to Newport? And I don't know why. I sincerely don't. And I keep saying, you know, I know I'm going to die and go to hell, but when I do, I'm going to get a day pass to heaven. And one of the things I want to ask my mother is, why did you let Nate take me to Newport? Because I still don't understand. But in those days, I wore high heels, which... I haven't worn high heels, and so, I mean, I wouldn't know what to do in high heels. But I know, you know, actually men still wear, I used to wear dresses too, but the most powerful men wear dresses. The Pope wears a dress. That's true. And you look at, you know, the men wear, you know, the men do, but I wore dresses then, and so I think I looked good. And so Nate took me to Newport. I think Nate must have needed to show that he was cool. And that's before, you know, my skin broke out. You know, I'm 74 years old. I did say to my students recently, I got a couple of students, I did say to my students, you know, if you want to be a writer, and then I'm going to read this book, but if you want to be a writer, if you're going to be a poet, the one thing you can never worry about is making money, because you won't, right? But the one thing you have to have faith in is that there's always a corner. And that's the way I feel. So if nobody ever buys my books, I always feel there's a corner I can stand on, and even at 74, somebody. That's the truth. You've got to have that kind of faith in yourself. Now, I probably wouldn't make what I would have made 20 years ago, but I'm sure that there'd be a little food and somebody throw me a blanket or something. But Nate took me to see Big Maybelle. And so I got dressed. I was thrilled. And we drove over to Newport. The room was dark. Dank, actually. It was, after all, Newport, Kentucky, preserver of sin and soul. My boyfriend, whom my parents trusted, though Nate did not deserve their trust, was taking me to a nightclub. George Rattleman would be sheriff one day and close Covington and Newport down, and Cincinnati would suffer. Cincinnati had gotten the clean money, the living room, Mark Murphy, Les McCann, the mighty Amanda Ambrose, fresh from Chicago. Newport had the blues, and gambling, though your biggest gamble was probably with your life. I wore high heels then, and my dress was just above my knees. I drank gin fizzes because, let's admit it, that's not a drink. Nate said I have a treat, so Mommy let me go to a bar that was dark, down dank steps, where I coolly walked in with one of the gamblers whom everybody knew. We could see through the back before the performers came to the mic. The stage jingled. "Candy," she belted out. "I call my sugar candy." And there she was, 2 tons of incredible womanhood, balanced on stiletto heels, wrapped in a black silk dress, talking about her candy. And I, who was born in Knoxville, Tennessee, met one of Tennessee's greatest gifts to the world, the girl from Chattanooga. Shake it, baby, shake it. This woman, who would never sell Girl Scout cookies or be seen collecting for diabetes, she would never make calls for crippled children somewhere in Africa, nor head up the blood drive in her hometown, no. She'd be leaning over the back fence in a man's pair of house slippers with a cigarette just sort of dangling between her lips, laughing. Yes, ma'am, this was Big Maybelle. I stamped and clapped and shouted, "Shake it, Sister Maybelle. Shake it, girl. Shake that thing." I love it. So I did a lot of those kind of things. I had the pleasure, a couple of days ago of being in Philadelphia with, I guess, 4 or 5 of the high schools, and it was good. My advice, you all are too old, so this is, I'll share what I'm saying, but it won't, you know, y'all are too old already. And what I wanted to say to the kids was, don't smoke. And so they all looked, you know, like, and I said, you don't want to smoke because you can't go to space if you smoke. Well, that's not true. You can go to space if you smoke, but you can't come back because your organs will move around and you'll die. You know, so if you have grandchildren, tell them now, don't smoke. And you might say, well, Nikki, they don't want to go, but they're going. And we do know, yeah, we're going into space, there's no question. You know what I love about D.C.? The one thing I love about D.C. is your Union Station, and you've got that lovely, lovely statue of A. Philip Randolph, which was designed, as we all know, by Ed DeWitt, who was the first black astronaut that they kicked out because they were jealous. And Ed DeWitt, that's who, and Ed decided, okay, I don't have to be an astronaut. I'm going to make my space here. But we're going to have people into space. And I think space is really wonderful. But we know this. We know we got to send black women into space. And the reason, I know some, we're not all black here, but the reason that we have to send black women into space is that black women, having come through, we all did, black and white men and women, black, not that many. You know, finish your sentence, Nikki. You know, there were more white women explorers than we admit to. There's some history there that the white women have not really claimed in the way they should. But we know the black women who were sold, bought, put on a ship, and brought over here, who are going to create, and they did, on the way over. They're going to create music and stuff. But more what I know that is important about black women is that when we came to what is going to be ultimately called America, we came to an alien name, alien place, with people we didn't know, who abused us, whose children we had, who we named and loved and did the best we could with growing up, with whatever we had to do. And so the only people that are prepared to go into space, to go up to Mars or go up to Saturn, because the same thing that let us get along with these fools here would let us get along with the people up in space. So we have to send the black women up. You know, it's true. You know, can't you imagine making love to somebody from Mars? I just think it'd be, I just think it'd be incredible, you know. You come back, we'd be talking, Nikki, what you been doing? I've been screwing this Martian girl. We're the only ones that are going to understand that, and whatever we have in us, we will birth, and we will love, and we will name, and we will teach them what we've learned. I have a lot of faith in black women. I think everybody should be a black woman. I know we all can't. But for the, but for those of us who are, it's a wonderful thing. You know, we just look in the mirror every day and say, damn, I'm a black woman. No, it's got to make you happy. It's just got to make you happy. It really does. So I was still, I mean, this is a part two of the book that, a part also of the book that I wanted to talk about. And I just wanted, I guess I just didn't mind being idiots or whatever it is that I am. And I really recommend your 70s, by the way, for those of you who are only in your 50s or so. I recommend your 70s because whatever it is that you've done it. And whatever it is that you haven't done, you won't. And it's a, life opens up in a different sort of way. And people like me can remind you, and I will, there's no such thing as a mistake. It's only something that you've learned. So whatever you're doing, you've learned it, and you go on. And mostly, it's about the enjoyment. It's about the love. And I think that love is a good idea. So for all of us who love something, whatever it is, good for us. And I've done my 20 minutes, so I know they're going to snatch me off stage because I'm a storyteller more than I am anything else. I'm a storyteller. And so people say, you got 20 minutes. And yesterday said, you have a half an hour. And I said, well, can I say just one more thing? And they're like, no. But we had a situation, because some of us are hokies here. And I've only met two queens in my life. One is Queen Juanita from Kano, Ghana, speaking of Kwame. And Kwame was, he built, for 3 years, he was there building a library, and he had asked me to come over. And I would really do anything for Kwame. I do love him so much, and it's just like, yeah. So I went over, and we did that. For those of you who have not been to Africa, who have not crossed over bridges, any bridge, you know, the swinging bridges, let me just do this favor. Do not wear jeans. If you wear jeans crossing those bridges, the ants will come up under your, and I was doing that, and I was, you know how you're scratching? And I finally realized something is up my pants. And, you know, everybody has those cameras now. You know, you have that iPhone, whatever they call it. And I had to stop and take my pants off. And I said to Kwame, if I see a picture of this, I will kill you. But you do it. I did learn that. You cannot wear shorts. If you're doing it, wear shorts. But the other queen that I met was Elizabeth. And, you know, it's funny. They called her people. I'm sure she didn't care one way or the other. But her people called and said, you know, Queen Elizabeth would like to meet you. And I'm sure she didn't know or care. And they said, would you mind? Somebody's here from Richmond. So would you mind coming to Richmond? Well, it's Queen Elizabeth. So it's like, oh, yeah, sure, yeah. So I did. I went over to Richmond, and you know, they got you line up and stuff. And they you know, introduced, you know, Madam, this is Nick, and she's like, Nikki Giovanni. Well, I know about meeting famous people, and she's way more than famous. So I know if you're gonna do something with her, I had something I wanted to say to her, but there's no point in saying it because she's not gonna listen, so you have to get her attention. And the way you get her attention is that you're standing there, and then it's gonna make her not nervous, but aware. And so she looked back up, and I said, Madam, we have something in common. It was nice of me. And now I do have her attention. And she said, oh? And I said, your great-grandmother, Victoria, invited my school, invited the Fifth Singers to come and to stay with her for several months, and they performed the spirituals. And she awarded them, though they earned it, £50,000. And they built the first hall there, and they call it Jubilee Hall. And there's a painting, and the painting there is from the court painter. And I just thought you might like to know that that's what we had. She said, yeah. Yeah, because a lot of times you meet people and, you know, you be black and stuff, so you think you don't have any way to, you know, nobody's paying any attention or you don't have anything to say. But, well, you know that's true. And so, it's, you know, you do a little bit of your history and say, oh, yeah, I got a lot to say. And I thought, well, you asked to meet me, right? And so that's what I was doing. Plus, I like Philip because he's done a lot with animals. And if I had been younger and Philip had been younger, I'm sure that we might have had more in common than Queen Elizabeth would. Oh, Philip is cute. I mean, well, how often do you get to screw the man who sleeps? I mean, come on. Well. But Philip is cute. But that I shouldn't say that. And I know there's a child here. And their parents probably like, oh, damn. I thought that I was going to a poetry reading and now this fool. But I just wanted to, I just thought you might like to share that because there are a couple, I know there are Hokies here and I know that there are some Fiskites here. And we sometimes forget what we have in common because we let fools like that one that occupies 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue divide us. And we have to keep finding a way to come together because, of course, he can't read, but if he could, well, you know he can't. Trump is one of the dumbest people you've ever run into. But if he knew something, he would see this is where America is, this is where we're going. And America there's no point to any of the nations anymore. All of that needs to, for the youngsters in the room or for our grandchildren, or in many cases our great-grandchildren, we need to be teaching them we live on Earth. So as we go into Mars, as we go into space and we run into a life form, they say, who are you and where are you from? You can't even say, well, you know you can't say Washington, D.C. That doesn't even, doesn't make sense. You know, taxation without representation. You know you can't do that. But it doesn't make sense to say even I'm from North America. You're going to have to say something that they can understand. We're from planet Earth, third planet from the yellow sun. And then they'll say, this is who they are, and we need to be teaching our kids we're from Earth. And that what we have in common, of course, is that we are from Earth. And if we have any sense, we'll take care of it. It won't flood away, it won't burn away. And so we're all sort of counting on us to do as good a job with it as we can. And I wish us well, you know, I sincerely do. I think that Earth deserves a lot better than what we've got now. And I'm really, really hoping, I'm hoping we get a good governor in Virginia.
I should say before we start, we probably have time for about 10 minutes worth, so we might have to cut it off at a certain point, but we're happy to have as many as we can. Thanks.
Good evening. I don't have a question. I just want to say I first heard the name Nikki Giovanni way back when I was in junior high school, and I want to thank you for the album Truth Is On Its Way and the poem that I always remember, Ego Tripping. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good evening. I just would like to know what was your inspiration behind Leap for Bridges? Page 88.
I was going to say, I'll have to see if I remember. Page 88? Oh, that's a love poem. it's a love poem. How you keep your feet warm. I mean, that's why you have a lover. Isn't that what they, at my age, maybe 20 years ago, there would have been some other reason, but now, yes. It's to have somebody watch the news with me and put my feet on. It's so basic.
How are you doing, Nikki? My name is Chloe Akil, and I have a question for you. My question is there any particular way that you want people to view you, or do you care how people view you?
I don't think about it. You know, lately, and I must look, something must be going on, because people are saying to me, like, how do you want to be remembered? And I said, oh, wow, I don't want to be remembered. I want to be here. No, I was a good friend, though she had closer friends, I'm sure, of Maya. And Maya spent a lot of time dealing with, you know, this is where I want my stamp to go, because she figured that one out. She had that. This is my picture. This is what I want said and stuff. I figure if I do the life, I'm going to let somebody else do the death.
I hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It is such an honor for me to be in your presence again. And I have the most tremendous memory of a day, 1970s, early 70s, at Howard University. And we had a day. You were there, Sonia Sanchez, Angela Davis, Sweet Honey in the Rock. You are not going to hell. Because the power and the energy from that day, it was like yesterday, and you all brought so much of truth and the light, the reality of life. You're not going to. If you are, I'm going with you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hi,
a young
Nikki.
Man standing there. A little boy. He's okay? Yeah. I don't know if he had a question. You know, you see kids, and then kids feel like, you know,
sure.
You know, I have a rule, too, and I shouldn't probably say that to this bookstore, but I'll stay here till the last book is signed, because, you get tired of the last person is always being overlooked, or if you're short, you're always being, you know.
Sure.
Hi, Nikki. Hi. It's such an honor to meet you tonight. One really quick thing. Could you please share with us any fond memories of your late friend, Dr. Maya Angelou, with us?
Well, see, I ended up, and the reason that I wrote, I think there are three things in here on Maya. And the reason that I did was I had different requests coming in. And at first, I think the first person that asked was like Ebony or one of those, you know. And I think they called me, and I said, oh, yeah. And then I got another request, and my first thought was, well, I've already written it. And then I thought, well, as long as I've known her, I should be able to do it again. So I did it again. And the main thing that I think I wanted to say, almost in many respects, you were talking about why did I write Leap, but the main thing I wanted to say to the writers in the room is that you have to remember, don't let other people control what it is you have to say. Because there's always something to say. What I didn't say, and if I'm not mistaken in anything, you know, Maya thought she could cook. And she wasn't she wasn't a bad cook, but I am a good cook. And in terms of the writers, so the best cook was Margaret Walker, to tell you the truth. And I used to go down to Jackson, and Margaret and I would cook together. It was just really wonderful. But what Maya and I would fight about, I make the best rack of lamb. I hope that we're not vegetarian to be upset. I make the best rack of lamb. And we were having a discussion, because she made some really good chicken, and that's the truth. And Maya, and this is not a secret, I mean, she's gone, but Maya kept a gun. I don't, but Maya kept a gun. Well, for a lot of reasons, she's well known, and you know, you never know with people. And I would go down, I don't really drink well. And so I would go down, you're talking to Maya did, what does she drink? She drank bourbon, because Tony drinks Tony drinks vodka. And so if you're sitting, spending time with those people, and you're trying to act like you've grown, you get drunk pretty easily. So I would spend the night there. And she made chicken one night, and I was upstairs reading, and I thought, oh, I want another piece. And I remembered, Maya has a gun. So it's good to remember these things. So I and I thought, I hope there's no light that comes on when you open the refrigerator door or anything like that. And I went and got my chicken and went back upstairs. I didn't I didn't get shot. But as we were, she and I were discussing something else, and I said, well, I clearly make the best lamb. And she said, you don't. I said, yes, I do. And went back and forth. So she said, come down. I only live 2 hours from her. So I went down. I got more tickets. I have not had a ticket since that girl has gone to heaven. As a group. And I went down and I made my rack. It was, oh, it was incredible, just melting. Because I'm really good. And she was like, it's okay. I was just jealous because I make a better one. But it was just, you know, I just wanted to, and there are probably other people that have other things. And one of the things, and you know, one day, speaking of one day, there are people in this room who know me in a different way. And it's perfectly all right. As I say, I'm going to do the life. And it's perfectly all right for somebody else to do what they know. Because we're really human beings. And everybody wants to make you do something that you weren't. And I do know this, though, by the way. I don't drink alcohol. And not even with Tony anymore. And I really love, I don't know if you've seen Tony recently, but I really love Tony. And of course, she's in a wheelchair now, so she can drink all she wants because you don't know if she's drunk or not. that's the truth. But those girls can hold your liquor. You know, you have to learn that. And I get to have one glass because of this stupid seizure. I get to have one glass of champagne a day. And so I'm hoping to get, thank you, because that's sad. I mean, and I keep saying, well, I'm feeling better. And my doctor, we're all arguing about it. My PhD and my MD are all, well, one is enough. Well, I'm saying that because she knows me. One is not enough. I mean, at least two, damn it, it's a football game. I was watching, you know, Miami. Well, you needed red wine to watch Miami. That was sad, you know. It was. It was just, well, anyway, I don't know if that's an answer. I mean, I know you're sorry you asked now.
No. We have our little friend.
Okay, well, then he's okay. Yes, sir. I can hear you. That's okay.
How many poems have you written?
Oh, I've written about 30 books, so I don't know what that would be. But it's fun to write. And as a youngster, one of the things you'll do, you'll write, and you'll sing, and you'll dance, and, you know, all of the things, and then you'll find the art that suits you. And that's the main thing, that it makes you happy. Always remember, if you write, though, you are your first, you heard me say that, too, you're your first reader. You are your first reader. And people forget that. They write and they say, oh, I wonder what the people are going to say. I wonder what my editor is going to say. I wonder. You are the first reader. So if it doesn't delight you, if it doesn't make sense to you, if you write poetry, it has to look the way you want it to look. It has to be what you want it to be. And you have to remember that always remember there's a street corner. Always remember that. That's the truth. So, you know, you don't have to, well, then you don't have to be sucking up under anybody. You can remain free, because there's always a street corner. That's the truth. I actually, we're laughing. Somebody said I won't go to hell, but one of the reasons I probably will is that which is not published, unless if I drop dead now, there's a book. And for those of you who are jazz fans, there's a song called "Make Me Rain," and it's just an incredible. And I decided I would just steal the title, and so I had finished this, but I started working on "Make Me Rain" because I heard it, and then I was driving, which, you know, they're not letting me do right now either. And I just pulled over to the side of the road and I wrote the poem because I had said, oh, I'll write it when I get home. But you forget things when you get home and the dog needs something. And I just pulled over and wrote it. And then I said, oh, I've got a book. You know, I've got a book. And so right now I have about 20 poems. So if I drop dead, I've got "Make Me Rain." And that's not unpublished. Those would be in that book. And knowing, I run a very small business, and I mentioned that I run a three-person business. Some of you know, Jenny runs a calendar, and Gloria is my attorney, and me. And so, knowing the two women I'm leaving behind, they will publish it, and they'll probably come and talk about and sell it, you know, knowing them. But no, they're sweet people. But I don't have any poems floating like that. There's not going to be anybody's going to find something and say, oh, she didn't do that. And the poems that don't work for me, that just whatever it is that's not making it, I just destroy them. And yeah, because you'll remember. I did one thing today, and I'll share it for any of the writers in the room. I was reading a thing on James Baldwin, and Jimmy was always there. We're talking about, you know, Jimmy is a confessional and how he really does, you know, life and stuff. And I think Jimmy did a good job. But I was looking at that, and I was thinking, my thought still is, we confess to God, we are honest with our art, and they're two different things. The confession is different from the honesty. And I think we have to know that, because we keep making people want to lead confessional artistic life. They want to say this, this, and this. And that has nothing to do with it. The honesty has something to do with it. But we confess to the Lord. And so we have to make sure that we're not confusing the Lord with our art. You know what I mean? And so I've got that line sitting around. I when I come off of this tour, which will, I think it'll be Friday or Saturday, I am going to sit down with a nice glass of champagne and, well, champagne is God's gift, and kind of work that out, because I think that's true. And I think we have to be careful. I am an honest person. Let me put it another way. And my honesty means a lot to me, but I'm not confessional. So he asked me a question. I don't know what he thought I was going to answer, but I can honestly say it's a love poem. But I'm not going to confess to whom, under what circumstances, because it's none of your business. Some of my, well, it's not. Some of your life belongs to you. And you have to be careful to keep what is yours to you, or as I keep saying it, but see, sometimes you hold the book and tears come, and that's all right. But I can give you the honesty, but I'm not going to give you the confessions.
Right.
Yeah. I think we have time for one more.
Okay. I hope you would do an ode or a poem to lamb. It is my favorite meat. And I hope you will tell us how you prepare it. Just a couple of things, because I knew of you from Professor John Gravely, Dr. Gravely.
Oh,
yes, many, many years ago.
Uh-huh.
And he also was a prolific writer and creator, and I know he probably had some influence on you. I applaud you for what you did at Virginia Tech, because you came forward. It's a very, very sad story, and it still goes on. But you were the only one to stand up, to take a stand and say, this young man needs help. You know, take him out of my class. And they did not do, they took him out of your class, but obviously they didn't do what you recommended. And, you know, folks need to know that. But you were brave enough, and you deserve any kind of bravery reward for that. I like Nikki Finney. Have you met her, and have you influenced her in some way?
Uh-huh. I mean, you know, I knew Finney from a long time. Something came up, not recently, but a couple of years ago, and somebody asked Finney, she was doing a reading, somebody asked Finney, well, did Nikki Giovanni influence you? And I was sitting in honest, I said I gave her a name.
Yes, 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 yes.
But yeah, I know Finney, and I've known her for a long time. You know, her parents aren't doing well. I think the biggest influence on Finney, or not, nobody influences like that, but Toni Morrison was a big, big, big help to Finney and her career. And I think that Finney has been incredibly rude and ungrateful, but a lot of people are, and she'll get older and get over it. But that's the truth. You get sick of that, you know, but I don't think, I mean, people listen to me is listen to me, but Tony meant a lot. And we, you know, Slade died.
Mm-hmm.
And when Slade died, I went down to see Maya and said, what do you think we should do? Because both of us wanted to do something. And we decided to invite all of the writers. It was an incredible, just incredible affair. And we invited all of the writers to come. It ended up being at Virginia Tech. And people came and they read their favorite Toni Morrison. And speaking of public life, of all of the things that I've done in public, and I've done a lot of public affairs because I do good ones, this was one of my, no, I do. My thing at Lincoln Center was great. My thing at Birdland was great. I do. But this was very good because we, Maya and I did it together. It's the only thing we did together because Maya died shortly after that, as you know. Mm-hmm. And Tony came on stage, and it was just so wonderful. And she said, and that was all she had to say for the evening, if nothing else happens in my public life, this does it for
says
me.
Says it all. Yeah.
I was just so, I mean, Maya and I was just like, we were so pleased. The president sent his plane for her, you know, because how are you going to get it? Well, the president sent his plane. I mean, it was wonderful. And so I was a little upset with Finney because she somehow was busy.
Unfortunate, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, those of us who are daughters and sons of Howard University, we certainly know you from there. Yeah, the Mecca. And we certainly know Toni Morrison because she is, you know, Howard University through and through. And we love that.
I just ran into her because I was in Philly, and I ran into a couple of Howard University guys, and they were like, I went to Howard. I said, oh, couldn't get into Fisk, huh?
Well, some of my best friends got in and did Fisk, okay? But nothing is better than the Mecca, okay?
Fair enough. Fair enough. So thank you all for coming out on a rainy day.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.